Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
You've reintroduced some of the Simple Solutions videos. On your Instagram. So if you're not following Bill on Instagram, is Bill Hartman PT? Is that
Instagram? Yeah, at Bill Hartman underscore PT, I think is what it is.
Bill Hartman underscore PT. It's on Instagram. But yeah, Simple Solutions video. So it's like you've got discomfort in your elbow when you're doing a bench press. So this do these three things and recheck your activity. But it's like, and they're offered as these sort of simple solutions with one or two steps, but getting to the point of understanding what to do in those situations takes a lot of knowledge. It's sort of like the, you know, like a plumber or an electrician might come to your house and charge you $80 just to walk through the door and say, and just flip a switch. And you're like, oh, well, why am I paying you $80 just to flip a switch? It's like, no. It's like he put in all of this time. He worked on his craft. He was in a, did an apprenticeship and all of these things to learn that he needed to flip that switch or he needed to tighten that bolt.
It's like you're paying for experience in that circumstance.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, simple solutions, they're simple in representation, not simple in the actual, like, understanding the solution. Because you think about this, you have to understand, okay, foundational representation. So those are your two archetypes. Then you have to understand the sequence of events that would get you into a certain situation. Then you have to understand, like, when you reach a constraint, like, so what happens when you actually hit a constraint under those circumstances? It's like there's an increase in pressure. There's an increase in tension. There's a position. There's a shape change. There's a modification in the center of gravity. There has to be an understanding of the mechanical element of breathing and how that influences that shape change. And so you have to put all of those things together and then you reverse engineer it. Because if you think about long ago posted a sequence of events, I think there's a 3 exercise sequence for medial knee pain. Right. So you have to kind of see that sequence go through space and then you can reverse engineer those in sequence. And then that's basically what I did with that series. But it's like I said, it sort of combines all of the elements that we talk about. It's like that's why we, you know, when you look at the you go to the network and you go through the model 101 course, it's like now you start to see the reasoning that goes behind some of those solutions, but you still have to have the experience of going through those stages, right? And understanding each element as it changes and why you would say arrive at a medial knee pain versus a lateral knee pain, because the mechanical elements would have to be different under those circumstances, right? So we're going through this long process to get to that, right? To like the constraint and like a pressure related phenomenon on the medial knee has a different twist to it, if you will. Like making a little pun there, but it's the reality is that there's a different twist on the knee that would result in pain on the medial side of the knee versus the lateral side of the knee. Just like if we went to an elbow, like we would have a similar scenario where we have a differential in the elbow that produces a pressure or tension related phenomenon on the lateral side of the elbow versus the medial side. Right. And we could talk about, you know, how that relates to throwing. Right. Similar mechanical elements in play when medial, the ulnar collateral ligament injuries to baseball pitchers are very similar in frequency, right, for the like an ACL and a knee. And those are all mechanical elements that have to be in play for those injuries to occur. And so that's how you have to be able to identify those situations to be able to reverse engineer them. And the thing that we're trying to do with Simple Solutions is like, okay, how many of those elements can I influence with what appears to be a simple exercise. You go to the, I think there's one that has like, I don't know, 50,000 views on it. It's a curl. It's a curl variation. But there's like a sequence of events that you have to go through to make that curl effective, because we have to consider the proximal influences. We have to consider the segmental influences that are in play. And then we have to create the intentional interference. So this is how you create a mobilization when you don't do manual therapies, is you create an intentional interference. And we've talked about this on the rolling video, on the webinar, the rolling webinar, as to how this would occur, where you have a bottom up influence and a top down influence, and where they meet actually creates the differential that sort of undoes the sequence. So if we talk about twisting a knee, we have to have a bottom up position and a top down position that produce the relative position at the knee joint. If we're talking about knees, same thing at the elbow, same thing at the wrist, same thing at the shoulder.
Right. Okay. So let's, you know, to giving, saying like, hey, if anybody has medial elbow pain, do these two things. Mm-hmm. Explain to me how you can say that when you have like two different ends of a continuum for the wide and narrow archetypes. Like how can a medial elbow solution be the same for a wide or a narrow?
Well, first of all, I don't state it as an absolute, right? Uh-huh. Because we're dealing with complexity here. And so we could have, again, there's a series of medial knee pain videos for a reason, is because there's a stepwise process that might resolve the first one. The second one might be required. And then the third one might be required to fully resolve this situation. But everybody goes through all phases of propulsion. Yeah. So everybody has an early, everybody has a middle representation, and then everybody has a late representation. And so those sequences are absolute regardless of archetype. And I think there's a little bit of confusion in that regard, is that people think that, oh, if you're IR biased, that means you don't have the ER. It's like, no, it just means that your representation of it is lesser than say a narrow ISA. So we're talking about the two extremes of archetypes. So we have a very narrow, narrow, and the very wide, if you will, and their representations of early, while similar in the fact that you're going to have an ER bias with IR superimposed, that space is going to be smaller for the wide ISA individual than say the narrow. And this is where we would see differences in force production versus velocity in generally speaking. Right. So two different archetypes can produce a similar outcome. They will have to use a little bit different strategy, but they're going to go through the same phases of propulsion. And right. So when we're coming up with a solution to something, what we're actually doing is we're utilizing the mechanical elements that we would produce from the center of our bodies outward, or the ones that we would have to sort of absorb from outward inward, right? And so then we can create a conflict, because it's going to be a similar position for if we could use the word diagnosis under this circumstance. So like I said, we have a lateral elbow pain. There's going to be potentially two primary reasons why that's going to occur, because it'll be a pressure-related or tension-related phenomenon in most circumstances. Like, there could be destruction of tissues, which is potentially a different representation, but we're just talking about a purely mechanical influence. So these would be situations where it's not a tissue-related phenomenon that is causing the symptom. It would simply be a mechanical element that, if we change that mechanical element in a favorable way, that would resolve the symptoms.
Right.
Because go ahead.
So I'm thinking about like when you have these points, these typical points of failure, call them, all these different segments, these transitional segments or joints. Typically what we're trying to do is take some type of twist out of that area. Are we ever trying to twist something more? Is there ever an instance where something is untwisted that needs to be twisted that's causing an issue? Do you know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh. Like, is it no, always... I know exactly what. Yeah. So we want to use the acquisition of internal rotation. Okay. That would be a representation that you're talking about. So let me give you a for instance. So in a late propulsive representation, there's an external rotation bias. That would be an expanded representation of structure. In regard to let's just use like a long bone, for example. So like a femur. So femur would be in its longest representation under that circumstance. So at dead center middle propulsion, where the vertical forces are greatest, you're going to have the greatest degree of compression applied to that bone. As you alleviate the IR and recover the ER, that should re-expand. So we're talking about a spring. So if I'm stepping forward with my right leg, I have an expanded spring. As I put pressure into the ground, that spring compresses. And then as I move over that leg, and now like my ground contact would be perceived to be behind me, I have the re-expansion occurring under that circumstance. Okay. So on the front end, I actually have to be able to accumulate this IR, which means that this is where relative motion becomes really, really important. And I have to be able to turn inward and create these compressed representations. So we could look at a tibia, we could look at a femur under those circumstances. They both have an ER'd representation. They both have to acquire internal rotation, which would be that compressed area. So if I had, let's just say that I'm trying to acquire hip internal rotation, I wouldn't want to manually apply a mobilization into internal rotation in a representation that was already compressed. So let me give you a for instance. So if I have an anteriorly oriented pelvis, so that's a pelvis that is actually pushing down hard on the femur. So the mass is up over the femur, it's pushing down and it's compressing the vertical dimension of the femur. So if you could see the femoral neck in real time, you would see it compress. So the femoral neck sits at about 120 degrees relative to the shaft of the femur, give or take, plus or minus, right? It's like there's a range where they would say it's normal. But if I had if I could compress it down and it looked like it was more like a 90-degree angle, I wouldn't want to mobilize that harder into internal rotation because its representation is already in a compensatory IR strategy. If I push on that, I make the compensatory strategy worse. I actually increase the degree of anterior orientation. I increase the compressed representation into the femur. So this is somebody that would say, oh, you lack internal rotation, not understanding the difference between relative motion and orientations. Okay. They try to mobilize that hip into internal rotation and they don't get a return on investment or they make it worse. Right. So somebody comes in, they mobilize it, and the patient, instead of the patient going, wow, that feels so much better, they say, oh, it's actually like it's a stronger pressure, a stronger impingement, or it doesn't change. Right. Because you didn't identify the appropriate representation before you applied a strategy. And again, this becomes important of understanding the difference between relative motion, internal rotation, and then the compensatory strategies. Okay. Now, if I try to induce that internal rotation into the hip from the ER shape, now I actually have something that's viable because I'm moving it from one position to another. It's like a different phase of propulsion. I'm mobilizing it from an ER position to an IR position. Now there's going to be value in that. I'll most likely recapture that element of IR that I'm attempting to recapture because I moved it from the expanded representation towards the compressed representation. And then the hope is that I can actually recapture that. And so now I have an early phase of propulsion that starts in ER. I can now recapture the internal rotation, right? So again, this is when mobilizations work and when they don't work, right? And so going back to the simple solution idea, it's like those simple solutions can't be for everyone, but there's going to be circumstances where they will work quite well. And you can see it in the responses. People go, wow, I can feel the difference already. Or they go, it didn't really change anything for me. And that's okay. It's like what we're doing is we're trying to give people options as to what representations they may have, which again, right. that's why there's a sequence of events in some circumstances where some of those videos are actually tied together.
Yeah, and there's, you know, a lot of assumptions have to be made when you do, when you make videos and posts like that, which is why
they're generalized.
You're not really the biggest fan of doing that just because of that. But it could be, I mean, one of the main reasons why you might be in the camp of people that are not experiencing success, or that like you are so far outside of your base of support to start.
Right.
And your setup for each activity is still outside of the base of support.
Correct.
So you're never set up to actually reacquire any of the space, or like you're saying, superimpose the downforce on top of that space with the activities.
Correct. Yeah.
So it's like, I could do a curl where I just squeeze really hard with my like index finger and thumb side, and I kind of rotate my hand out to the side and then I do it.
Yeah.
And I think I'm doing it the way that you're doing it in the video, and it hurts.
Right.
Yeah. But all I'm doing is just hanging out on the outside of my feet, the outside of my base of support, and just doing what I think is the right activity.
One of the things that I also think is important that I am controlling for is I'm not producing compensatory strategies with the activities that I'm offering. Like every simple solution is intended for reacquisition of relative motion or control of position to produce an outcome.
Yeah.
Whereas every once in a while I get sent videos and people want me to try to explain to them like why would this work? And it's not my video, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, okay. And they'll give me a demonstration of some activity. And some of those activities that people are offering actually create compensatory strategies that can alleviate a symptom.
Yeah.
So let me give you a for instance. Somebody says, oh, here's a solution for hip impingement. Right. And so then they show somebody doing a series of activities, and through observation, you can actually see where the movement is taking place as they're executing these. So, I will give you like a very specific example of a compensation that actually alleviates hip impingement. If you create a lumbar compensatory strategy in external rotation, so people will see this as by tradition, they're going to say it's a flexed spine. Okay. Under this circumstance, because of the previous limitations that have been identified and then the diagnosis that would go with it, which kind of tells us where the target of limitation is. So like anterior hip impingement, okay? If I create a compensatory compressed spine and bend that forward, it actually creates a space for me to turn inward with another compensation. And it can alleviate a symptom. So it can make a hip impingement appear to be resolved. It alleviates the symptom because you're actually using another part of your body to substitute for the hip to move the leg into a position in space, but it's not acquired through a relative difference between the hip socket and the femur as we would want it to be for relative motions. But again, because a space is created and a compensatory strategy can be used, you don't put pressure in the same place, but you're not actually in the same place to begin with. And so we have to be very, very careful when we're offering viable solutions. So this happens clinically all the time, which is why it's so important that when you do an intervention with someone, and you get a result that you measure, like a favorable result by symptom, and then you measure and you go, oh, that wasn't the intention that I was going after, which would be, say, relative motion at the hip. So I'm trying to actually create true internal rotation of a joint, and I create the compensatory strategy by accident. I alleviate the symptom. And instead of, you know, patting myself on the back and going, way to go me, now I have a concern, because it's like, okay, I know it feels better, but this was not the solution that we were going for, right? So we have to be very, very careful with how we identify the outcome,
right? I mean, because there's
favorable, less pain, yes, good. Yes. Not favorable in regards to the strategy. That it's like take a golfer with a swing fault, right? Give him another swing fault, right?
Yep.
And he goes, oh, wow, that's so much better. But the reality is, it's like now he's got another influence that he's going to have to account for.
Yeah,
that can actually cause a problem later.
It could, yeah, or it might not. Like the thing about some of this stuff is, like, you know, before you being introduced to this model, I was giving people like left spinal orientation strategies, like I was just doing it for years, for 5 years, 6 years, and it got people out of pain and it got people back to moving better. Although it was just an orientation strategy, but it's like, it's not necessarily a definitive thing that if you teach someone to orient to the left versus like recapture range of motion, that they're going to, like, you know, have an injury because of it. But you are just creating another compensation on top of they're already doing. And I want to give an actual like example of this. So what we're talking about, I think they're, although the only people watching this at this point are the people that are on the network and are probably UHP Plus members, because they have this, they'd be interested in us talking about this, but
correct.
To, like a left posterior capsule stretch for the hip would be like a good example of an exercise that's given to a lot of people to try to like create space and shift someone into their left side. But when you put someone in that position and you have them hold it for long enough, they will figure out a way to bend themselves into that position. And what you're saying and what I'm trying to show as an example is that that can happen completely at the lumbar spine, where I bend and I turn the spine to create like that sort of hump that you see on the left low back of somebody when they're in this position. That is where the space is being created. There isn't like some magical stretch happening in the posterior capsule of the hip, because I need to reorient the pelvis. I need to reorient the sockets, and then I need to use the proper muscle activity to reinforce that. I can't just like push someone into it's literally trying to take a square peg and just jam it over time. It's nice and slow into a round hole.
Right.
There will become a way, like I can get plastic sort of tissues to change if I push on them hard and long, but that result is just going to give you like this sort of lumbar flexed turn to the left instead of that ability to recapture the space and then move into the space from right to left.
Well, there's, you know, and just to give people an idea, it's like some of the structural abnormalities that are going to show up on imaging are associated with those compensations. And we've talked about this before, where like a herniated disc is a substitution for motion in that direction. So if I have a left posterior lateral disc herniation, it's because I didn't have motion in that direction. There was so much pressure. And then I unfortunately had destruction of disc material that allowed that to give way and finally actually move in that direction. But it's isolated because the rest of the system is trying to not go in that direction. And so then we have this focal local tissue based change, right? That becomes an unfortunate circumstance, right?
Yeah.
But the recognition of why that happens is like, oh, I needed motion in that direction. I got it. But again, I had to sacrifice tissue.
Yeah. That herniation and bulge is the micro representation of what I was just talking about. So imagine imagine that hump through the low back on the left side that's creating space. Take that at the level of each spinal segment. That's the hump there, is that space that's being kind of blown into. It's the softest constraint in that system. So that's where
space. Very particular. Yes, we have to be very particular because I could have a spondylolisthesis. That does it's the same strategy, just at a different place.
Right.
Yeah. So we have to account for those things.
And that can happen. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, we're just trying to avoid those compensatory scenarios.
Right.
And so, but that's why, Go ahead.
Sure. I want to circle back to the left posterior hip capsule thing, because it's just some of the things that I'm trying to like over explain it, just because I've had to think about this a lot over the last few years, is that like the reasons why people feel a stretch or they feel better after doing something like that. It's also like understanding what range of motion that person probably had before even trying to get into that position, like bringing that left knee up so that it's in like a 90 degree flexed position. That position in regards to relative motion probably does not exist for someone that has left-sided pain, because they probably are toward the end of their compensation sequence. And they don't really have the ability to flex that hip past probably like 30 degrees, maybe
not,
less.
Not with relative motion.
This becomes one of these sort of caveats in situations where people are like, well, I do this activity with everybody and they all feel better. So like a good example of this would be like 90 degrees at the hips, 90 degrees at the knees, pushing down through a box, hip lift, tucking your tail, you know, turning your hamstrings on to allow yourself to whatever you're trying to accomplish in that position. If somebody, like you're saying, if somebody cannot flex both hips with relative motion to 90 degrees, that disqualifies them from doing that activity. But everyone still continues to use said activity, and they're feeling like it's helping all these people get better. All that you are doing, when you do not have the requisite ranges of motion to get into the setup for whatever activity you're choosing, is you're creating a compensatory strategy somewhere. Correct. And a lot of times when we're talking about the hips and things that are hip centric, that compensation is coming from the spine.
Correct.
Yeah.
Especially the position described would definitely be a spinal compensatory strategy. Yeah. But this is why, you know, when we talk about process and execution of reverse engineering, it's like, how do you know what stuff to give people? It's like that. So you have to have some measurement, some key performance indicator that you're going to follow. That's going to tell you whether you were successful with a movement. So if I create a spinal compensatory strategy, you're going to get one of two representations. I'm going to get a magnification of external rotation, or I'm going to get a magnification of internal rotation, but I'm also going to sacrifice the opposing strategy. So if I increase ER compensatory strategy, I'm going to lose IR, relative motion. Okay. It's going to look like you were successful if your intention was to increase external rotation in one circumstance and you were successful with external rotation, but you give up IR, which means you did not recapture relative motions. So right away, you know you've moved into a compensatory strategy. The freedom of movement, however, will feel easier. And then your client is going to go, wow, okay, so we were successful with that. And then in the back of your head, you're going, no, we weren't.
Right.
Because if my intention is relative, so this is ERs and IRs, then I was not successful.
Yeah. And the ER replacement or the ER substitution will come from spinal IR. And the IR substitutions will come from anterior orientation.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, the anterior orientation includes the spinal
ER.
Spinal shape into what? No, it's an IR'd spine that allows the anterior orientation. But when you roll it backwards, that's a posterior orientation, which actually brings the spine with it into the forward bend that we're talking about, which creates the ER. Right. And so again, it's like you have a spine that's sort of like bending back and forth like a bamboo pole, and you're not actually utilizing the relative motion at the hip because you don't have access to. That's the concern.
Sure.
And now you got a spine that moves like it's kind of like bending an old credit card back and forth, right? Where you get the little crease on it, and then eventually it just goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And then you wonder why you get the degenerative changes in facets, or you get degenerative changes in the disc, or you start to see the arthritic changes in the foramen, because there's so much pressure on the spine and it's just bending back and forth. It is not using, like, joints that have relative motion don't show wear and tear to the degree that joints that don't. And we have to understand that. And so again, if you're creating these compensatory strategies and then superimpose time on that. It's like somebody continues to use that compensatory strategy. That's where like bad things can happen.
Yeah, because if you have all of the compensations that we're talking about and you're using these spinal compensations and you're using the whole pelvis is just anteriorly oriented, the stuff as it goes down into the pelvis, like the guts and the fluids and everything as they go down are just kind of going and just crashing into the abdominal wall, right? Like that's why hernias happen. There's no pistoning down into the pelvic, the outlet.
So like if you have an inguinal hernia, so that's a pressure related phenomenon. That means that the pressure up top relative to the bottom is greater, so that there's more pressure going downward. And then that pressure, that downward pressure has a certain amount of volume in your abdomen. And that pressure is just water under pressure. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to seek the path of least resistance. So it's going to find the easiest constraint to push against. And so those who have experienced an inguinal hernia, it's like, that's why you get them.
Yeah. Right?
It's a sign of your physical structure and then the strategies that you use under those circumstances.
And you'll also see this in like pooch bellies or, you know, like you see like really skinny, fit model type of women who are very narrow that have the sort of like pooch and the popularity of high waisted athletic pants has gone up significantly in the past 2 years. And they work out like crazy, but they can't get rid of this like little. They think it's like this last bit of fat, and it's like that's not fat. That's just guts. No. Like that's the stuff trying to go.
Literally, yeah, it has to have some place to go. The other thing that people don't quite recognize is you know these pressure related compensatory strategies squeeze. They like if you squeeze the top and you push down, it's like you get shorter, and then those people that are very very lean. That have like they would call it a fat roll, like right above their waistline on like
muffin
they
top.
Put their pants on. Well, I don't want to go that quite that far to it, but yeah. Okay. But it's like, okay, so you have skin and then you have the adipose that's underneath the skin. And so like, if I reduce that vertical dimension, it has to bulge out somewhere. Like it has to go somewhere.
Yeah.
Right. And so you can diet yourself to the gills and you have that last little bit of what appears to be fat to resolve. It's like, good luck with that, because it's actually the fact that your training includes the ability to squeeze harder. Like if you're training
from the
for
top
hypertrophy
down.
From the top down, if you're training for hypertrophy or you're training for force production, it's like, you're going to learn how to squeeze over time. And so if strength training is part of your regimen, actually just if you're living life, because we're always dealing with gravity and we're going to push up, you know, and gravity's going to push us down. So you're always fighting that battle. So as you get older, it's one of the reasons why you'll see like crazy lean old guys, right? That still have that little, what appears to be that little bit of fat roll around the waist. It's like, you've just lost vertical dimension. It's like, unless you can recover that, it's like, that's always going to be there.
Yeah.
So this discussion took a turn for the worst in it. Like all of a sudden with this representation, now we've got a bunch of people that are going to go, oh, I'm not really fat. I just have, you know, I have a,
well,
I have a pressure
certainly
compensatory strategy.
It's like, yeah. You can, yeah, it's like that's what you're fighting against, right? It's like the narrows are always going to need to have some type of be able to provide, their training should try to provide them with the appropriate bottoms up strategies to keep fighting that fight. Like it's the whole Sisyphus thing, right? That you mentioned in your last post or one of your last posts.
Yeah.
It's like, you're always going to be pushing that you're literally pushing it uphill. You're trying to push that rock uphill for the rest of your life. Like, and it's going to be a struggle because the path of least resistance, especially for an ER biased person, is down and out.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, they have a tougher time acquiring that middle propulsive high pressure shape, right? They have a smaller space to do it in, right? And so we have to be very, very particular under those circumstances. It's one of the reasons why I love box squats so much, because of the way that we can actually influence that behavior. Because if we do have that behavior, then we don't have to use the compensatory strategies that we would use to push down into the ground, right? Because if we're just pushing down and we don't get the expansion, like if we have to use a top-down compression to push into the ground, we don't have the relative expansion that actually holds us up. And so eventually, this is why you're going to see, you know, the rounded shoulder, you know, posturing that people would complain about. It's actually an anterior compression that's bringing the shoulders into that position. But
right.
But that's why you start to see these compensatory strategies, right?
So simple solutions, not so simple. But the reason why...
No.
But the reason why that you can give the same three activities to someone regardless of their archetype is because we all go through the same phases of propulsion. And yes. I would say further that the more when you're having some type of issue with discomfort, you are going to be farther outside of your base of support and being pushed farther forward. So
correct.
if these activities are designed to bring you back and within your base of support, regardless of archetype, it should be helpful.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But again, there's going to be particulars that might be unaccounted for under some circumstances. Cause again, we're still generalizing, right? Whenever you have that situation.
And we're dealing with human beings who are morons. Generally speaking, not to pick on anybody because I'm picking on everyone. Like everybody is stupid.
We are all included.
Yeah. Everyone, even present company is included in the moron pile. But yeah, so it's like, we'll all find a way to mess things up if given enough time and resources. Okay. What would be a good thing to talk about? We talked about Harry Potter last time. What's something that you could ask for the old people that the young kids wouldn't know anything about? So you and Dale can talk about it.
Let's see. We already talked about. You know what popped into my head was like your favorite Brady Bunch episode.
I think getting the football in the face.
Oh, Marcia, when she's in the
Marcia.
Oh my nose! Right? Yeah. Okay.
That's very good. That's my favorite.
Man, there's so many good ones. I could just knock out a bunch of them. Like, the day that Greg went to high school for the first time and he was dressed like a hippie type guy. He bought the flashy clothes and went to school that way and kind of embarrassed himself. Or let's see, when Peter had a date with two girls at the same time in the house, and one girl was in the living room, one girl was in the family room.
Oh yeah, that is a good episode. I remember that episode.
We had to go back and forth. He had to change clothes back and forth, and one was a costume, so that was good.
That's coming to goals, right?
Mrs. Brady lost her voice over Christmas, and she wouldn't be able to sing. And then it turns out she got her voice back on Christmas Day, so there was your Christmas Day miracle.
Yeah.
Davy Jones being on there, so one of the monkeys. It's like, come on, man! It's like they're all great. When they went to they went to Hawaii, and Greg wore the idol, got hit in the head by the surfboard.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like we got a lot of them. So if you know your favorite Brady Bunch episode, throw it up.
Yeah, go ahead and put your favorite Brady Bunch episode up, or go on Google and research what is the Brady Bunch.
the greatest concern that I have is that I just rattled off like a series of memories, and then I struggle to remember like what I was talking about yesterday.
Yeah.
remembering to fix
our YouTube monetization.
Yeah, exactly.